Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where once again I shall be continuing my story of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic. Last time, if you remember, I finished up more or less my story of Caesar's campaigns in Gaul. And as promised, I said I'll go back a fair few years and tell you what happened in Rome during all that time and the story of Pompey. This mini-series, although it's not that small of a series, is it? This mini-series is supposed to be about both Caesar and Pompey because their lives and careers are so heavily entwined. So let's go back to Rome in the 60s BC and talk about what happened with Pompey. Okay, today I'll be reading from Appian and Plutarch. And also, if you've watched them, I have already done episodes on Crassus and Cato. So I shall be covering some of the same ground again, but from a slightly different angle, perhaps. So let's pick up with Appian, more or less when Caesar leaves Rome for his French campaigns. So Appian tells us this, quote, "Caesar realised that his absence from Rome would be prolonged, and that the resentment felt towards him would be all the greater because of the enormous favours he granted." See, now, Caesar knows that the election he had just before he left Rome to become consul, and when he, Pompey and Crassus, formed the first triumvirate in secret, though it wasn't all that secret, Cato cottoned onto it pretty quickly. Either way, he knows that that, plus the election he had before that to become Pontifex Maximus, he knows that once he leaves office and he no longer has immunity from prosecution, he knows that he's going to be prosecuted for all sorts of things. So he knows he's sort of on borrowed time, that is, unless he can keep a string of offices going. But he knows that Cato and all of Cato's people, his faction, they will try and get him. So he's got a few years to try and untangle all of that and save himself from being ruined, if not actually imprisoned or exiled or even executed. Appian continues. "So he, Caesar, married his daughter to Pompey, although she was engaged to Capio," and someone else called Capio. Caesar sort of forced her to break that engagement and marry Pompey, who is much, much older than Caesar's daughter. He's a little bit older than Caesar. So he's much, much older than Caesar's daughter, Julia. And yeah, I've said before, I will be repeating myself a bit in this one. They actually fell in love. Pompey certainly, absolutely, genuinely fell in love with Julia, to the point where the normal people of Rome, the scuttlebutt around the city of Rome, was that he was too in love with her, that it was embarrassing, that a good Roman man doesn't really fall head over heels in love with his wife. There's something not quite right about that. All the great men of philanderers. But Pompey did absolutely fall in love with her, and it seems, even though he was much older, she genuinely liked him, and there's no accounts or no evidence that she was sort of repulsed by him or was terribly upset that she was forced to marry him or anything. So, but that is important, that marriage alliance. If you remember before this, when Pompey was casting around for allies, he tried to marry into Cato's family, tried to marry someone in his family to Cato, but Cato wouldn't have that. So just again, to put it in a bit of context so everyone's clear, we've already had the Catiline conspiracy. We've already had Pompey defeating Mithridates and the pirates. We've already had, of course, the war with Spartacus. And so there's all these alliances forming. So Cato and Cicero are sort of for the Senate, Optimates. Cicero is a bit of a special case. Perhaps after this mini-series is finished, I'll do an episode or two just talking about Cicero. A lot of the time, Cicero is a bit of a wild card, although Cato is something of a wild card. He's not in the sense that you know that he's always going to stand on his principles and you know what those principles are. So it might be maddening that he does that, but you sort of know where you are. You can rely on him to stand on his principles, whereas Cicero bends with the winds a bit more. So Cicero's alliances come and go. You know, like, so for example, Cicero is a big fan, pretty much a big fan of Pompey. And at this stage, anyway, sort of kind of suspicious of Caesar, but doesn't hate his guts, but is absolutely not a fan, kind of hates Crassus, and has a funny relationship with Cato. Nominally, they're absolutely on the same page, but sometimes Cato does things that aren't in Cicero's interests or baffles Cicero in all sorts of ways. So although they're on the same side, they're not always exactly on the same page. So that's Cicero. Crassus and Pompey hate each other. They kind of absolutely hate each other because still Caesar is kind of, well, definitely is still the junior out of the three triumvirs, Crassus, Pompey and Caesar. Caesar is still the junior partner very much. Crassus is the richest man in Rome and is old, sort of in his late 50s, knocking 60. And Pompey is absolutely most decorated general of the age, easily. So Pompey and Crassus are the two big hitters out of the three. And they hate each other, even though they work together and they've been consuls together before, haven't they? If you remember, they couldn't actually get anything done, really, during that year when they shared the consulship, because they sort of still see Caesar as the junior partner and that each of them are the other's main rival to be the preeminent man of Rome. So although they're not, haven't resulted to sort of murdering each other or anything like that, they are certainly politically complete enemies. So that's something to have to bear in mind the whole time. And Caesar's sort of trying to play them off against each other wherever he can, or begins to anyway. Caesar is friends with Crassus. Crassus lent him loads of money, for example. And he's sort of friends with Pompey. Well, they are friends. Well, certainly now that Pompey has married his daughter, that is quite a good alliance, quite a firm alliance. But out of all of these three, the real reality is that you can't really escape, is that each man wants to be the preeminent man of Rome. So they're friends and enemies to varying extents. Again, it's not a complete cutthroat situation where it's just a matter of time till one of them gets the other murdered. And none of them are best friends. So it's a delicate balancing act. But certainly the marriage alliance between Pompey and Caesar sort of helps balance the balancing act to some degree. Okay, Appian continues that after Pompey married Julia, he tells us that Pompey did that. Appian goes on to tell us that, quote, he, Caesar, also placed the staunchest of his supporters in the magistracies of the coming year. He announced the election of Ulius Gabinius, one of his friends, as consul, and himself married Calpurnia, the daughter of Gabinius's fellow consul-elect, Lucius Piso. This caused Cato to exclaim that political primacy was now procured by marriage broking. Cato always had a dim view of that, that women should be involved in the balance of power in any real way. Cato was, of course, super old school. He had sort of values and ideas of the sort of mid-republic era. But so Caesar's trying to set up, get all his ducks in a row so that there'll be people in Rome while he's away that can sort of bat for him, try and make sure that his position isn't just completely destroyed or undermined, you know, through political machinations he's somehow stripped of his command and brought back to face charges or anything like that. So he's playing a game from afar. And he absolutely needs Pompey and Crassus, as well as other people, like Gabinius and Piso, to be defending his position at all times, for years on end. It is a really difficult political game he's got to play. He's got no choice. His enemies are implacable. Cato is implacable. We'll get him if he can. Appian continues. As tribunes, he, again Caesar, chose Vatinius and Clodius Pulcher. So, Clodius, again, he's part of that fashionable set among the populares. Caesar is, of course, a staunch populares, always was, always will remain so. And Clodius Pulcher is the other main leading light in that faction. So Caesar making sure, putting strings so that Clodius can become a tribune of the people. If you remember, I told you that Clodius is part of the Claudian family, one of the most blue-blooded families there is in Rome, and that he had to renounce his patricianship. He had to sort of formally, legally renounce the fact that he was an aristocrat in order to become a tribune, because patricians can't become tribunes. Tribunes are supposed to be the champion of the people. So Caesar sort of allows that to happen, in fact, oversees it, so that Pulcher can then be a tribune. And it's the Republic still, so tribunes are still very, very powerful. Once we get into the Empire, and certainly the later imperial period, tribunes are not powerful, or nowhere near as powerful anyway. Whereas here, in the 50s, 60s and 50s BC, tribunes can still be extremely powerful. They can still bring government to a screeching halt and be a fly in the ointment of much more powerful people, of the consuls themselves. They can veto many laws and all sorts of things. And Pulcher, of course, is going to be both going to bat for Caesar, but more, really, going to bat for the popularis cause and eventually for himself, because he is extremely ambitious. As a Claudian, he will expect to be right at the heart of things, come what may. And he's a bit of a crazy man. If you remember when I talked about him, I must have talked about him during the Crassus episodes and the Cato episodes. You know, he was the one that was caught disguised as a woman, perhaps trying to bed Caesar's old wife. So he's a bit of a crazy man, wild man. And first up on his list of people to do away with, people that might undermine the popularis cause and Caesar, and because of just a personal vendetta, is Cicero. So on that, Appian tells us, quote, the latter, Clodius, had once been suspected of having sexual designs on Caesar's own wife when he was caught at a religious ceremony for women. Caesar himself, in spite of divorcing his wife, because Caesar's wife must be above suspicion, had taken no legal action against Clodius because of his great popularity with the people. Of course, the people absolutely love Clodius because he's their champion. But others prosecuted Clodius for sacrilege at the sacred ceremony, and Cicero lent his support to the accusers. If you remember, the Senate had a tribunal to decide whether they were going to put Clodius formally on trial for that. And Cicero spoke against him. And then in the end, he was acquitted anyway because of bribery. But Clodius did not forget that. He didn't forget that Cicero tried to sink him, tried to get him exiled. Clodius holds a grudge. And yeah, there's no way he's going to forget what Cicero tried to do to him. Appian again. Though called as a witness, Caesar did not denounce him and now made him tribune as a way of plotting against Cicero, who was already blackening the compact of the three men to secure sole power. In this way, their needs outweighed their grievances, and they did a favour to one enemy in order to avenge themselves on another. And it seems that it was Clodius who first repaid Caesar by helping him to the Gallic command. Such were Caesar's actions as consul, that is in the year before he goes to Gaul. And as soon as he laid his office down, he immediately left Rome to take up the next, i.e. the command in Gaul. Clodius impeached Cicero for breach of the constitution because he had put Lentulus and Cethegus and their followers to death without trial. So that's a reference to the Catiline conspiracy. I've got a whole episode in conversation all about the Catiline conspiracy and the way that was dealt with. It seems that there was some sort of true conspiracy by the senator Catiline to sort of maybe do a military coup d'etat, maybe do something along the lines of Sulla, entering Rome with a body of men and just proclaiming yourself just de facto ruler through force. Seems like something like that was afoot. And when it was thwarted, Cicero happened to be consul at the time. This is back in the 60s BC. In order to deal with it, he just arbitrarily had them executed. And that was against the law. You know, there was still due process, certainly for full Roman citizens, certainly for senators and things. And Cicero did ride roughshod over that. Now, at the time, he was hailed a hero, a saviour of Rome for doing that he acted quickly. He needed to act quickly to save Rome from some sort of immediate peril. And the fact that he did, he was lauded for it at the time. But now, in hindsight, now Clodius is a tribune, and sort of bring lawsuits against people, he's dragging that up. But it was illegal, though, so by letter of the law, Clodius can do this, and so he does. And Appian tells us how Cicero reacted to having a very serious lawsuit brought against him. Appian says, quote, "Although Cicero had displayed a most noble spirit of resolution in the affair itself, the Catiline conspiracy, when it came to being prosecuted, he collapsed. He put on miserable clothing and threw himself down, covered in filth and squalor, in front of those he met in the streets, without even being ashamed of bothering people who knew nothing of the matter, so that thanks to his inappropriate behaviour, he became a figure of fun instead of an object of pity." So Cicero reacted poorly to this. He didn't have a stiff upper lip. He seems like he collapsed a bit. And, you know, Appian suggests that he was trying to garner pity, but everyone just thought it was pathetic. See this, the one-time consul of Rome and great man, one of the most famous lawyers, prosecutors of his age, one of the greatest orators that Rome had, reduced himself to filth and squalor in the streets, and that people just laughed at him. So it is a bit funny there, sees that Cicero lost his nerve, it seems. Or perhaps it was just a ploy, as I say, to garner pity, but it backfired. Public opinion didn't have sympathy for him, for whatever reason. Appian continues, "Such was the state of cowardice he fell into under a single case which involved himself, a man who had all his life won a brilliant reputation in the case of others. In like manner, they say Demosthenes, the Athenian, did not even wait for his case to be decided, but went into exile before his trial. When Clodius even insulted him by interrupting his pleas in the street, Cicero abandoned all hope and, like Demosthenes, embraced exile voluntarily." So according to other accounts, apparently in the life of Cicero and things, what happened was Cicero is in the streets, sort of trying to garner pity, but just seeming pathetic. Clodius and his toughs, his thugs, his gang, his mob, come up to Cicero and basically threaten him. It's still not enough that he's been reduced to that for Clodius. Clodius is then like, "You better watch out." It's like basically words to the effect of, you better watch out, or you know, you're going to have an accident if you're not careful. In other words, probably best if you leave town, or we're going to badly assault you or kill you. That is the type of person Clodius is. There's no doubt about that. He's, you know, a killer, a gangster. And anyway, Cicero doesn't have to be told twice. So he just flees. Appian gives us the parallel of Demosthenes. But Cicero, he's no fighter, right? He's not about to try and muster a gang or a mob of his own and have street fights with Clodius's mob, or have any sort of one-on-one combat with Clodius, fight, whether it be with daggers or swords or fisticuffs or clubs or whatever, in the street with Clodius. That's not how Cicero rolls. He feels he's got no option. Probably he doesn't have any option at this point, but to flee. So he does leave Rome. It's sort of a self-imposed exile. And he hates it. He very, very much resents it. Appian continues telling us, a crowd of friends accompanied him out of the city, and the Senate sent letters commending him to cities, kings and petty rulers. So he shan't have to live in poverty, at least. Clodius pulled down his townhouse and his country residences, and was so elated by this that he now compared himself to Pompey, who was the most powerful man in Rome. So Clodius, not content with humiliating Cicero, destroying him politically and threatening him to the point where he has to literally flee for his life, he also destroys his houses. So Clodius is not someone to mess with. Clodius plays for keeps, always. As I say, he's a bit of a crazy man, a bit of a wild man. Appian continues. The latter, however, Pompey, encouraged Milo, who was more audacious than Clodius, so that's pretty audacious, and had succeeded him in office, to hope for the consulship. So Milo's a tribune now, and he's in the pocket of Pompey. He's Pompey's man in all sorts of ways. And incited him to oppose Clodius. He also instructed him to put through a bill for Cicero's return, in the hope that when Cicero appeared, he would be induced by his memory of what he had suffered to say no more about the current political scene, but would embroil Clodius in legal proceedings and other complications. Right, so that's quite a big thing there that's happened. Pompey has decided that he's had enough of Clodius. Because Clodius, by this stage, I've mentioned this in the Crassus one, and probably the Cato one as well, that Clodius is becoming some sort of de facto ruler of Rome. That his mob, his gang, they can force the assembly or the Senate to do what they will. And so this tribune is, you know, once again, a troublesome tribune, is subverting the Roman state, the Roman Republic. And he's even started in on Pompey himself. Now he's got rid of Cicero, it obviously emboldened him even more. And he actually starts on Pompey and Pompey's party, Pompey's faction. In fact, Clodius even had some of his men sort of posted 24/7 outside Pompey's house. And whenever Pompey would come or go, they would sort of jeer at him or even throw rotten veg, things like that, to sort of undermine him or unsettle him, or to just sort of send him the message that even the great Pompey, who celebrated three triumphs, is the greatest military man of the age, even he is going to need to submit to the reality that Clodius is in control in Rome. Well, Pompey won't have that. Pompey's a different man to Cicero. Cicero has never had a command. He was never a military man. Cato can't be intimidated. You just can't intimidate Cato. It's not going to happen. But you can intimidate Cicero, but Pompey won't have it. If Pompey wants to, he could just go and get a couple of legions and invest Rome and wipe Clodius and his men out if he really wanted to do that, if he wanted to go full Sulla. Never go full Sulla. But if he wanted to, he could. But he doesn't decide to do that. Instead, he decides to try and fight fire with fire. Okay, we've got a troublesome popularist tribune. I'll get my own tribune, this Milo character, and I'll get him to thwart Clodius legally in all sorts of ways. And if and when that doesn't succeed, Pompey, I'll create my own gang, my counter-Clodius gang, and put Milo in charge of them, if needs be. Pompey's just not going to put up with any attempts to intimidate him on the steps of his own home or anything like that. So, finally, someone's pushing back significantly against Clodius, and it's Pompey. Now, how much Clodius is basically acting entirely on behalf of Caesar? Most people think that probably not. At some point he was, at some point their goals and aims completely aligned, but very quickly, once Caesar's gone for a year or two, Clodius is just acting for himself, wants to be a player completely independently of anyone, including Caesar. And Pompey's just not going to have that. Oh yeah, and he also gets Milo to recall Cicero, because Cicero would be, or is, a very great tool of oratory. So Pompey's decided to pull out all the stops against Clodius, try and thwart him in the war of words, in the courts, and ultimately, in the end, on the streets. So Cicero is recalled, Appian tells us. And so Cicero, who had gone into exile because of Pompey, returned home because of Pompey. About 16 months after his expulsion, and his townhouse and country residences were rebuilt at public expense. They say that when he was received at the gates of Rome, in spectacular style by the entire population, the whole day was spent on greetings, as in the case of Demosthenes. Okay, let's talk about the same sort of thing, the same period, the same few events, this time from Plutarch in his Life of Pompey. And he says this: Pompey himself soon allowed himself to be weakly seduced by his passion for his young wife. Again, wasn't really a done thing for an important Roman to love your wife too much. He spent all his time with her in country houses and pleasure gardens and paid no attention to what was going on in the forum. The result was that even Clodius, who was now tribune of the people, began to despise him and to venture upon the most outrageous actions. He had driven Cicero into exile and had got Cato sent to Cyprus on the pretext of a military commission. Yeah, that was an interesting thing that Clodius did as a tribune. He legally gets the state to offer Cato a governorship on Cyprus. And Cato says to him, openly just says, look, you don't need me to be the governor of Cyprus. I'm sort of kind of above all that. I'm sort of at a praetor level, hoping to be consul one day. You're obviously just trying to get me out of the city. You're obviously just trying to do away with me so that you can do all the nasty, nefarious things you want to do. And Clodius and his factions basically say, yeah, well, yeah, kind of. Yeah, what are you going to do, though? But you're Cato. You always do everything by the letter of the law. And the law says that you're really obliged to go to Cyprus now for a few years, for a year or two. So what are you going to do? Break your word or do as you've always do, which is follow the letter of the law?
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.